I did mention we will be joined by Dr. Laura Bambrick. She's the head of Social Policy Employment Affairs with the Irish Congress of Trade Unions. Good afternoon to you, Dr. Bambrick.
Hi, Ciara. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you very much for coming on. So I did say it in the intro to the show that all workers will be entitled to the 10 days paid sick leave, but this is by 2026. At the moment, workers, well, it's not fully gone through the legislation, but what is planned, workers will be covered for 3 days from 2022, so this year, and then this will rise to 5 days in 2024, 7 days in 2025, and then reach the 10 days in 2026. So we have spoken to you many times before about this paid sick leave topic. If you want to kind of, I guess, explain a little more to us exactly what's happening at the moment.
Sure, Ciara. So as you mentioned, this will be good news for a lot of people. In fact, it'll be good news for half of the workforce. And they're the half of the workforce that don't, in their contract of employment, currently have any entitlement to paid sick leave. So if they're injured or if they're too sick to turn into work, it means that they either have to go without a day's pay, maybe take an annual day's leave, or turn into work and work through it, which tends to be the way. So what happened was unions have long been highlighting that Ireland is out of line with how other European countries treat sick pay. In all but three EU member states, up the road Northern Ireland and across in the UK, employers are legally required to continue to pay the workers' pay if they're too sick to work. In Ireland, it's a voluntary system, so employers can decide or not to make that part of your employment package, and it's in your contract along with your days' holidays and how many hours you work. So when the pandemic arrived, it was realised that, you know, workers would not be in a position to take time off if they came into contact with COVID. So listeners will be very familiar with hearing about the PUP and the wage subsidy, those emergency income payments that were put in place. But in fact, it was illness benefit was the first of the emergency payments had to be put in place because of our low coverage in sick pay. And this very much has been the catalyst to get us where we are today, to bring us into line with just a normal, very basic workers' rights. So as soon as it makes its way through, and there's every reason to believe that it will successfully make its way through the Dáil and the Oireachtas, from later this year, as you mentioned, workers will be entitled to 3 days paid sick leave at 70% your daily rate.
So Laura, let me just ask you in regards to those 3 days, if this comes into effect later in the year, when could that possibly be? June or July are we speaking about, or maybe in the next couple of weeks?
So we're expecting it to be done before the summer recess, before the Dáil rises,
right,
before its break in July.
So if that's before, would say, August time, right, does that mean that those 3 days can only be taken for workers between August and December of 2022?
Well, we're waiting to see the bill. What will happen will either, it will start at the calendar year, so you'll get your 5 days from the 1st of January next year, and as you said, you will be able to use, if you find yourself falling ill, between August and January. But there's an expectation that it might be the 12 months, so it'll be August then, 2023, when the 5 days come in.
Okay.
Like that. So we just have to wait till we see that whether the rollout, the extra days come into effect from the 1st of January of the new year or from 12 months when the bill comes into effect.
Okay, so the employers are paying employees at a rate of 70% of the employee's wage. That's up to a daily maximum threshold of €110. And that's based on the 2019 mean weekly earnings. This is the average weekly earnings of people in 2019. It was €786.33, and that equates to an annual salary of €40,889. There's lots of people listening to that, Laura, that will be thinking to themselves, I do not earn that amount of money, the average in this country. And at the moment, and it looks like it will continue, inflation is rising, things are more expensive, and it looks as if employers and the government will have to step in and start paying people more because they just cannot live currently.
Well, as you mentioned, 40,000 is the average wage. So the average gets dragged up by the number of high income earners and dragged down by the number of low income. But under that cap, that 120 daily cap, 60%, so 3 in 5 workers, won't be impacted by that cap. So it is going to be a benefit to the vast majority. And of those that earn over it, it's only those that are currently not getting anything off their employer. So they're still benefiting more than they previously would.
Yeah.
And this is the case if we look at other countries. This is what the case. No country, well, very, very few, gives 100% of the daily rate. So 70% is comparatively generous. And it will be a situation where that's just the floor, that's the bare minimum. And given that it's a workers' market at the moment, employers are finding it difficult to retain and recruit staff, you will see many employers in the contract of employment offering 100% income replacement when you're sick. This is just the bare legal minimum that has to be provided.
It's going to be very interesting to see how people change things. As you're mentioning, you know, retention of staff is affecting all sectors. Now, just to let people know, the rate could be revised, it's saying here, by a ministerial order in line with inflation, I'm mentioning, and changing incomes. The employee will have to obtain a medical certificate to avail of statutory sick pay, and they have to have worked for their employer for a minimum of 13 weeks. Again, I know everything is not set in stone, Laura, but when you discuss the medical cert, to get one of those, do you need to go, like, book a full appointment, if you get me, with your doctor that will cost you, would say, €60 to get your hands on one of those certs? Because for some people, that obviously may put them in two minds of even taking that day as a potential sick day.
This is definitely one of the areas of concern for trade unions on what is an otherwise very positive piece of legislation. So while it's normal practice in all other countries that when you're sick and you're claiming your day's sick pay, that you have to have your sickness medically certified, you have to provide your employer with a GP cert. The difference in the Irish case is we're really unusual in that workers have to pay for primary health care. You have to pay for a GP visit. In all other EU countries, health care is a right, it's an entitlement, you don't have to pay at the point of use. And we have real concerns that paying out that €50-60 for a visit and then the difficulty of trying to get to see a GP in order that you can ensure that you have your money at the end of the week because your bills will keep still coming through, that will act as a barrier to workers exercising this new entitlement. So that's something we'll be keeping an eye on very closely, how this impacts on especially low-paid workers.
Yeah, you don't want to be negative about something like this because this is huge in terms of this country, yeah, what's being spoken about being put in place. But we know even in this county of Kildare, there is a major lack of GPs. People who've moved to the county having to still visit or avail of their GP in neighbouring counties or even more further afield. So that in itself is going to be a problem, unfortunately. But look, it's nice to address all the problems and maybe iron them out before they become too impactful. Leo Varadkar, obviously the Taoiseach of this country, has said he accepted many businesses are struggling with additional costs at the moment because of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. He said Ireland is one of the few advanced countries in Europe, as Laura mentioned, not to have a mandatory sick pay. Laura, what do you say, or what would be your advice for people who are employers themselves and may already be dealing with the additional costs and struggling?
No, we do recognise it. And after all, trade unions are in the business of ensuring that, you know, there are jobs there for our members. And this is the reason why other listeners listening in that are workers might be saying, why do I have to wait another 4 years before I get my full entitlement? Government and trade unions recognise that a lot of businesses are struggling coming out of the last 2 years, and that's the reason why this is being introduced, rolled in, temporary introduction, the three days and 5 days and 7 days and 10 days, to allow employers factor that into their labour costs. And as we were talking about earlier on, we're in a really competitive market for workers, and that's true of attracting workers from abroad to come to Ireland. As you said, you get sick pay, you get a pension, you get better leave, you get more bank holidays if you work in other European labour markets. So if we want our own graduates to stay here, not emigrate, and if we want new talent, new skills to come work in Ireland, make Ireland them home, we have to be able to be attractive as employers in the EU. We have to be able to go toe-to-toe with what they're asking. So while it might, and understandable, feel like this is more pressure on employers, it really is about ensuring in the long term that we're competitive in the long run. So it's good for business, it's good for workers, and it's good for society that people aren't going out infecting each other when they're sick or if they're injured, being distracted and causing a workplace accident for themselves, their colleagues or other people they come into contact with.
Yeah, potentially we could learn a lot from the medical sector in this country and the amount of immigrants that go elsewhere, that have studied here, that are Irish themselves and study in terms of medicine. You know, we're mentioning the GP situation. That could happen in all sectors after something as seismic as this pandemic and the after effects and the comparisons that we've all seen, as you're mentioning, with other countries. Dr. Laura Bambrick, you're also always, I should say, so great with your time here on KFM and Kildare Focus. Thank you so much. You are, of course, Head of Social Policy Employment Affairs with the Irish Congress of Trade Unions. What do you think about the changes that are currently being discussed? 10 days paid sick leave by 2026, 3 days this year, 2022, and I'll go into the rest of the details a little later. Do get in touch with me, 0833 97 97 97. Now, moving to a different area altogether, I'm joined by Eilish O'Malley. She is the Chair of Friends of St. Bridget's Hospice and Home Care Services. Hi Eilish, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, it's lovely to be online with you.
Yes, well, it's indeed. Lovely to speak with you. Such a joyful voice, Eilish, I like to hear on a Wednesday afternoon.
Thank you.
Friends of St. Bridget's Hospice and the Home Care Services are having their AGM indeed. Tomorrow in the Cadine Hotel. Now, before we ask you all about that, Eilish, do tell me a little bit more about what exactly Friends of St. Bridget's Hospice do.
Right. Friends of St. Bridget's was, I suppose, set up primarily to help and support the hospice itself. Like, the hospice is run now by the HSE, and we literally do everything except pay the wages, because that's the way life is today. You know, the objective is to be a support to the whole community in promoting and supporting the aspirations of the hospice. That's basically the umbrella. And then with regard to that, we support and we help the whole of Kildare and West Wicklow.
Huge area, obviously, massive population.
Yes, indeed. I suppose we're lucky at the moment that we have Dr. Miriam Colloran is the fantastic clinical specialist there, and she has a wonderful team, an absolutely fantastic team. Sometimes we give out about the HSE, but one of the good things that happened in the last year, now I won't dwell, but they appointed Sarah as a quality risk and education CNM, which means that basically people can upskill, and we're supporting this by putting in place a bursary every year so that no matter who you are within the hospice, you can upskill to support you and the hospice in the work you do, you know, which is something great at this stage.
Eilish, I just want to ask you one thing in particular. As I was mentioning, you know, massive population. How is the volunteer or the system run in terms of Friends of St. Bridget's Hospice? Are you struggling with retention of people at the moment?
Okay,
great news.
Right. In the hospice itself, okay, there is a problem because nationally there's a shortage of staff. So we have 13 beds 9 are open because we can't get staff to have the 13 open. But that's a question for a national. You know, it's not the question for the Friends. We are there to support in whatever way we can the staff and the Friends and everything else that goes with it. So in that sense, the staffing issue is totally separate to our work. You know,
yes, absolutely.
Does that make sense to you?
It does. It does.
Right,
now,
okay.
In terms of the AGM tomorrow,
yes.
Eilish, it's happening at 3 o'clock in the KD.
It is indeed. Yes.
So,
yes,
tell us
yes.
what exactly will be discussed, and who can attend the AGMs?
Well, anybody can attend the AGM, and we love having people there because it's great to see people. Like, people don't come because of us; they come because somebody that they know or a relative has maybe been in the hospice. People don't necessarily want to go there, but when they experience the care and the support they get in the hospice, they are there. They're there to support us in that way. And for instance, donations that we get, we don't necessarily go out to fundraise because people support us through donations in all sorts of different ways, whether it's a golf club or whether it's cyclists or whether it's just people donating from a school or whatever. People donate because of the care that somebody they know got in St. Bridget's. Absolutely marvellous.
I have to say the people of Ireland and here in County Kildare, we have amazing people and they're very, very charitable. And in terms of donations, how can people, I know you're saying people out there are donating, you don't need to fundraise as much as possible, but how can people donate if they wish to do so?
Okay, if they want to at any time, you can go into our website and there's a PayPal option there to donate at any one time. That's a possibility. Other people just decide, well, look, I'll run a fundraiser, whatever, and that can be a group of friends or an organisation, anywhere can help and support us in that way. Like, we're open to any help and whatever support that we can get. And people are very good. Like, there's always needs. For instance, at the moment, in the hospice, they actually need extra space for storage. So we will help to make that a reality once the HSE give the go ahead. You know, there are simple things. Now, that's not a simple thing, but one of the simple things that at Christmas, one of the nurse directors suggested that they needed little lap blankets that people could sit in their chair and have a bit of extra comfort. We do that. We also pay for extra security, because security is provided during the day by a particular company, but then from 5 o'clock onwards, it isn't. So we support that.
Eilish, I'm just having a look here on the website. It's Friends of St. Bridget's Hospice.ie, and it's absolutely gorgeous, the grounds of the hospice. They look amazing. I know, I'm sure they're not in full bloom at the moment due to the time of year, but they look absolutely beautiful. And as you were mentioning, you can on the main page donate. There's a little tab there, very easy to find. Lots of details. Obviously, you're mentioning the extra hours of home care where necessary, the supplementary nursing cover, funding for training courses, security services you just mentioned, garden maintenance and their fabulous gardens, ambulance services, building additional patient accommodation, bursary for staff and other educational needs, and patient comforts, of course, which is one of the most important things. So the Friends of St. Bridget's Hospice and Home Care Services is a voluntary organisation with charitable status and is a company limited by a guarantee. It is defined as on its website. And if you do wish to donate or find out any more information, like Eilish has been explaining to us this afternoon, it's Friends of St. Bridget's Hospice.ie, and that is the chair of the hospice and the home care services there, Eilish O'Malley. Speaking about grief, very, very serious findings here. Anxiety, grief, fear, isolation and distress for residents, families and staff. This is highlighted in a study on the impact of COVID-19 on residential care homes. And the lead author of the report joins me now, and that is Dr. Mary Rose Sweeney. She is the head of school and associate professor at DCU's School of Nursing, Psychotherapy and Community Health. Good afternoon to you, Dr. Sweeney.
Good afternoon, Ciara.
We're going to look at some of the key findings here. Now, you know, one of the most obvious things to say, obviously, residents and staff, they're number one in terms of having any sort of residential care home ticking over day in, day out. And they do, you know, incredible work when it comes to the staff. But family members of residents is something that is not the first thing that comes to people's mind when they hear of reports like this. And one of the key findings is that family members experienced fear, distress, anxiety, loneliness, helplessness, frustration, and some experienced physical challenges such as being outside in all weathers, trying to communicate with their loved one inside a residential care setting via a window, obviously during the height of COVID-19 restrictions. It's something that would never pass many people's minds unless they themselves were living it.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So maybe I'll just tell you a little bit about the background, Ciarán, and what we did and what the aim was. So we set out to explore the pandemic as it was experienced by those who were on the front line, such as staff, residents and family members. And we wanted to gain insights about their preparedness, about the impact on them all, and about their support and training needs, and also to explore priorities for future waves. So we took a mixed methods approach. And in the first phase, we developed and administered an online anonymous survey to staff who were working on the front line during wave one of the virus. We also sent a similar survey to residents and family members. And in that survey, we gave an option for family members to be contacted for a follow-up one-to-one in-depth interview. So that was wave one, and then the interviews related to wave one and wave two of the virus. So 77 staff members completed the survey, 28 family members, and 11 took part in really in-depth, semi-structured interviews. And as you can imagine, there was a lot of data emerged from that. But the main findings showed, yes, of course, there were, you know, serious adverse impacts for residents. You know, it led to significant physical, psychosocial and social impacts. And, of course, high levels of stress, trauma, burnout for staff. But, yeah, an interesting sort of sub-finding, as you say, on family members who felt that their care input, which was habitual for them and expected, indeed, was for the main part suspended. And that had really adverse consequences on them. And they felt really grief-stricken and really traumatised that they couldn't access their loved one, that they couldn't communicate very well with them. You know, apart from, there was no direct communication, so it was either through a window or through the use of technology. And it was really distressing.
And just noting that, you know, staying on the family members for a moment, 98% of the residents couldn't connect remotely with their family members during the pandemic. So you're mentioning things like distress, anxiety and pure fear. We kind of find it, I think it's most humans, you kind of switch off that memory of fear or really bad experience because you want to protect yourself. And at the beginning of March and April 2020, things were so scary for everybody, whether you had relatives in nursing care homes, I should say, or not. It was a very, very scary time. And 98% of the residents, I'm assuming here, would be older and maybe not as technologically advanced as some of their family members, meaning they didn't have any sort of interaction. Obviously, it impacted those residents, but the family members too. It's just pure worry. And then, you know, you focus on the staff. They themselves couldn't be reaching out to every single resident's family to make sure that they were doing okay and let them know things were okay, because they were overrun by the situation that was unfolding in front of their eyes.
Yeah, that's right. And they tried really, really hard. And, you know, they made themselves available to help the residents use that technology when they could. But obviously, due to staffing shortages themselves, they were, you know, they were putting their energy and time into providing the direct care of residents that was needed. And that was rightly more of a priority at that time.
If we do focus on the impacts on staff, it ranged from information overload, obviously a lot to take in, what to do day to day. You know, for the first few months, masks wasn't something that was being advised. We'd say back in March and April 2020, they weren't advised at the time. Physical and mental exhaustion, supporting their peers. Obviously, colleagues themselves were scared of the virus. They themselves would have been infected and sick. And then managing their own fears. There was so much to contend with. It is completely unimaginable to for me to think what these people went through.
Yeah. And looking back, you're right, you know, but it's easy probably to, you know, sort of wipe it all away and think, gosh, that's a long time ago, but it was only in the last 2 years. And yeah, the information was changing and the new evidence was emerging. And so staff were being updated all the time by the Public Health Emergency Team, by the HSE, by HICWA, you know, so there was so much information coming at them that even having to cope with that alone, never mind all of the physical and sort of mental turmoil that they were going through and the fact that they were, you know, most likely doing longer hours than you know, they normally did, and that they were covering for people who were either self-isolating or who were ill themselves. And you know, they probably weren't seeing their own family as much as they would have normally. And they were probably fearful of bringing the virus home to their family members. But most of all, and I think this came out really strongly in all of the research, that they put the residents first, that they were of paramount importance.
Above their own needs, it's noted
above
here.
Their own needs.
And the staff did express their own distress at witnessing the impact of the virus on those vulnerable people they were taking care of, who were traumatised, alone and fearful. And, you know, they were literally left all alone at times, you know, with oxygen masks and, you know, not knowing how this virus would affect their bodies. And, you know, it's a massive thing, obviously, to be the person that's infected with the virus, but to also be, you know, fully fit per se and be witnessing that as somebody who should be caring for these people and taking care of them, that must do something to one's psyche.
Yeah. And don't forget, it went on for a long time as well. So this wasn't just like a week-long event. You know, this was quite a long period of months where they had to be firing on all cylinders, looking after other people and keeping going and making sure that things were done to the best of the circumstances at the time.
Now, if we look at the residents themselves in terms of the rate of infection, the underinvestment, it says, in state facilities did lead to people sharing bedrooms. Poorly ventilated common areas contributed to or facilitated the viral spread. The transfer of infected patients from acute hospital sectors and movement of staff across different sites resulted in increased virus spread. We heard of that happening in this country. We heard of it happening in the United States. You know, people still being contagious and infected with the virus. Going back into care homes. A higher proportion of staff and the family carers believe that the rate of infection could have been reduced by more effective or diligent infection control measures. And the family members believe that the residents who did not have family members to advocate for them, which is so incredibly important, were at higher risk during the pandemic.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really interesting finding. And you know, whether that is borne out in fact or not, you know, remains to be seen. We didn't actually collect information on that ourselves, but it was certainly a perception that was held by staff and family members.
Dr. Sweeney, you're obviously the head of the School of Nursing, Psychotherapy and Community Health at DCU. I was speaking with Dr. Laura Bambrick just a few moments ago of ICTU in terms of paid sick leave. And, you know, people know that there's a lot of, I guess issues in this country that need to be ironed out in terms of, you know, how workers are treated, whether it's the public or private sector. But if you're to focus on those who go through DCU's halls of nursing, etc., do you see a problem on the horizon in terms of people emigrating again and not wanting to work in this country, especially after the past 2 years? And we know now, just in the past hour or so, just in the past 20 minutes, the INMO have released a press release saying that emergency department doctors and nurses are to hold a virtual press conference tomorrow at 10:30 a.m. There's a lot to focus on and that need to be changed in terms of those who work within the medical sector of this country.
Yeah. Well, I mean, nurses have always moved across the world for career opportunities and for, you know, adventure and for excitement. But there are certainly plenty of job opportunities at the moment in Ireland for nurses, and we really want to retain them, and we really want to get nurses back home who have been working abroad.
So how do you make sure they're retained?
So the working conditions certainly are something that do need to be looked at, and the working environment. And I know it's the focus of a very large study called the Magnet Study, which I think has been led by UCC. This study is sites in Europe are being buddied up with sites in America who have established really good facilities for nurses for working. And so they're working together to try and improve sites across Europe. So something like that is a huge, big endeavour, I think, will be really valuable to improve working conditions for nurses.
Okay, well, Dr. Mary Rose Sweeney, thank you for joining me today. You're the head of School of Nursing, Psychotherapy and Community Health with DCU, and of course the lead author of this report, which is available to be viewed online, and you can just head to DCU's website, I believe, is where you can see it with the online library there. It's very interesting, and it's also very sad to read it. Thank you so much. That is Dr. Mary Rose Sweeney there. It is incredibly sad, especially when you're mentioning things like, you know, if you didn't have family members advocating for you. And one of the main notes to take from this is family and staff highlighted the important role that family members have in residential care settings for older people. Do get in touch with us this afternoon, 0833 97 97 97. Now, this county has lots to be impressed and entertained by and places to go. But Kildare Drama Festival is back. Noreen Quinlevin is joining me from the festival committee. How are you, Noreen?
Hi, Kira. How are you?
I am good, thank you very much. Where do you join us from this afternoon?
I'm Kildare Town.
Very good. The Drama Festival is beginning at CMWS Hall in Kildare Town tomorrow, the 31st, and it's running until Friday, the 8th of April. Do tell us what we can expect to see this year.
Great variety of plays this year. There was a shortage of confined groups, there's two sections, but this year we have three brand new plays, which is very unusual. We have our first opening night on Thursday night. It was Cornmill Drama Group, and they're coming all the way from Carrigallen. They have a play written by one of the crew, The Door on the Left, and then the next night with Kilworth Drama Group, and they've written play as well, but The Quiet Moment by Mike Finn. So he's part of their group. And then on the Monday, we have Butt Drama Circle. They're from up around Donegal. They're doing an incident with Dave Cotter, and that's by Sean Byrne, and Sean is one of the actors. So not alone did he write it, he's directing and acting as well.
Noreen, yourself, what is your role within the festival?
I am the chairperson.
Okay, and do tell us what that entails.
an awful lot during the summer,
you get a bit of a break during the summer. That's what you need.
Yes, absolutely. But it's a great honour to be part of the festival committee. I've been involved for a good few years now, and a few years ago then I was proposed for a chairperson. It's really getting down the nitty gritty and getting the hands dirty. You know, applying for grants, getting groups to apply for the festival, and contacting groups all around the country. And then the programme is a big thing, because people advertise, our local sponsors and patrons, they advertise in the programme. So you have to drop the letters, you have to go back and collect the money, and, you know, do the ads and make sure the ads are in order. There's a good lot to it, but it's great when you have the interest in drama, it's great.
And especially after the past 2 years, it's so lovely to get back involved with social things and get everything up and running again. So obviously tickets are needed to attend, and you can get them from the Heritage Centre in Kildare. I have the number here at 045 530 672, or you can visit Kildare Drama Festival's Facebook page, Noreen, and people can get more information there. Is there a pricing for the tickets, Noreen?
Yes, the general admission is €12 a night, and the season ticket is €50, which is great value, because, you know, after only getting eight groups, you have to see eight groups for the €50. There's a concession of €10 then, a concession ticket for €10. You can buy those at the box office. The CMWS, I don't know if you're familiar with it, it's a fine big building, so we're not actually restricted to what we sell from the Heritage Office. It's great to have it there, because they're accessible all day. But you know, we do have facility for walk-ins as well.
Well, Noreen Quinlevin, thank you so much for joining me, chairperson of Kildare Drama Festival. It begins tomorrow. You'll have your days off pretty soon in the summer, Noreen. Tomorrow is the 31st of March. Noreen, I can't believe that the day after tomorrow is April. Friday is April.
Well,
that's just incredulous.
You know, the 1st of April, God Almighty. But after last year not being involved, we were very lucky the previous year that we had just finished our festival when lockdown started. So
very lucky.
We're not as deprived as other festivals,
nope,
which had all their money and everything spent.
But I'm sure things are looking up now, Noreen. And
so if you feel like you'd like to come over for a night, just let us know and we'd be delighted to see you.
Well, lovely. Thank you so much for that. I really appreciate it. That is Noreen Quinlevin. She is the chairperson of Kildare Drama Festival, as we're saying, running from tomorrow, the 31st of March, to Friday, the 8th of April at the CMWS Hall in Kildare. Get your tickets from the Heritage Centre, 045 530 672. Also, Kildare Drama Festival's Facebook page.